The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to Moore College of Art and Design. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events, and I am molto entusiastica to welcome our author this evening. She joins us from Zurich by way of Montclair, New Jersey, and Venice to celebrate her 25th novel featuring the charming and incorruptible protector of all things Venetian, Commissario Guido Brunetti. Now, I'm sure we all have our own mental picture of Brunetti, but there's no longer any need for you to imagine the creator because she's right there. Please welcome Donna Leone.
Thank you all for coming. The setup for the evening is that I jabber on for about a half an hour, and then you ask questions, and then I sign books. So that's okay. What I'd like to do, I brought my notes. And there we are. Yeah, I thought that what I'd like to talk about tonight is sort of writerly stuff about this particular book, The Waters of Eternal Youth, which for those of you who have read the book is maybe the most blackly cynical title. Isn't it wicked? Ooh. Falling in love is pretty bad too, because there's the pun or the double meaning of the word. But I like this because those of you who have read other stuff know that this theme of eternal youth and the enchantment of youth is with us in literature ever since ever. Just, what is it? It's the third book of Gulliver, isn't it? When he goes to Laputa and sees the Strolbrugs? Those people who are granted eternal life, but they forget the small print, and they don't get eternal youth. And so when he goes into the place where the Strolbrugs are, they're all sort of lying themselves the puddle on the floor and wanting desperately to die. And there's Greek mythology, there's a young man, I believe, who is granted eternal life but not eternal youth. And so he becomes old, and the goddess that he is in love with. Who is it? Is it Endymion? Those of you who know the mythology better, who is it the guy who ages when his goddess lover does not? I can't remember. It's been so long since I read it. The idea for the book came because I had been rereading Ross Macdonald, who's a crime writer I admire perhaps more than any of the others, because of the quality of his prose. I think that he's really a wonderful, wonderful writer. I'm also, at the moment, I'm rereading Chandler, because I teach a course this summer, every summer, and I'm taking a Chandler book to discuss this summer, and I reread Farewell, My Lovely. And I was struck by Chandler's prose, but I was struck by how, in a sense, monochrome it is, in that it's almost always wise guy stuff. Whereas with Ross Macdonald, the metaphors and the similes are much more literary and are not tied to the time in which the book was written, as I fear is true of Chandler. They're wonderful. The comparisons he makes among people and between people, I'm speaking of Chandler here, are always wonderfully apt and very often very funny, because he does the ridiculous comparison, the kind of living oxymoron. Whereas MacDonald's prose is, I would say, more elegant. and not as tied to the times as are those of Chandler. At any rate, I was reading MacDonald because my German publisher published MacDonald and let him go out of print. Apparently the translation into German is not very good. I don't know, because I don't read German. And so I asked them if they would consider retranslating and reprinting, republishing the novels of Ross MacDonald. And I said that I would gladly offer them to write introductions to the various books if they agreed to retranslate and republish the books. And that led me to reread MacDonald seriously with the view in mind of writing introductions to the various books. And so when I did, I was struck, as I had been, I don't know, 40 years ago when I read Ross MacDonald for the first time, by the technique that he used in almost all of his books, where he would be, his detective, Lew Archer, would be faced with a problem or a case. Now, in 1950, 60, 70, whatever it was. And as he pursued his investigations in almost all of the books, he would discover that the reason for this year's problem is something that took place 20 years ago. He liked two decades. He liked 20 years. Sometimes it was 15, but very often it was 20. So the children, and in some cases the grandchildren of the protagonists of the event from 20 years ago, are being assaulted by the shadow of these horrible events in the past. Where is the body gone? Where is the person disappeared to? Why was that fact, why was that event, that suspected murder 20 years ago, why was that never resolved? And I thought, wow, that is really interesting. Because I read the books with a different mind, which was watching the way he built it, watching the way he constructed the book to keep things in chronological order. And I said, as I said when I wrote the first book, about 150 years ago, it seems, I wonder if I could do that, which is what happened with the, I've told this story before, which is what happened with the first book when I had the conversation with Gabriele Ferro and his wife about a conductor dying in the dressing room in La Fenice. I said, gee, that would be a great idea for a, if someone murdered a, I wonder if I could write a murder mystery. Yeah, why not? Give it a pop. And 26 years later, I still am. Anyway, I said, I wonder what it would be like to construct a book like that, with that pattern or that chronological problem to be resolved. So I said, yeah, okay, what would I do? What would I do? What would I do? What could I do? How about somebody died 20 years ago and the murder was never solved? How about they, but why would it sit around for 20 years and nobody would pay attention to it? Maybe it didn't seem to be a murder. Maybe it didn't look like a murder. Maybe it looked like an accident. Okay. So I started the book. And I thought, all right, what I'll do is kill someone 20 years ago. And then open the book now. God forbid I should do anything inventive. Why not just copy Ross MacDonald because he's so good? Have things happen now that somehow lead Brunetti into the past. So I said, yeah, okay. How about somebody asks him to investigate something, a death that happened 20 years ago? Why would they do that? What is a sufficiently persuasive motive? Not for Brunetti, but for you, for the reader, and for me, to insist on reinvestigating a case after such an amount of time. So I shortened it to 15 years because I figured my memory wouldn't keep all the things straight for 20 years. I said, how about someone who was dying and who had no rest, who had no peace because of those events those prior events. How about that person ask Brunetti to do it, but not officially? How could that happen? I said, dinner. He's at dinner with someone who is sufficiently important to him for any one of a number of reasons to have the right to ask him to do this investigation, and whose closeness would somehow oblige him at the not professional but the personal level to take on the investigation. So I had the dinner party where he meets Contessa Landi Contarini, Landi something, and she tells him that, no, Landi, is it Landi or Landi? Landi Continui, grazie. Landi Continui. She asks him, she tells him at dinner, she's a good friend of his parents-in-law, that she is troubled by the death of her granddaughter 15 years ago in an accident. She fell into a canal and drowned. So I went ahead with this and wrote about 100 pages. And after about 50 pages, I said, yeah, it's okay, but it's not right. And after 70 pages, I said, yeah, it's all right, but it's not right. Yeah, it's all right, but it's not right. And then one day, I realized what was wrong. This was a book in which the attention of everyone in the book and Brunetti, and consequently the attention of the reader, would be focused on that person. But that person's been dead for 15 years. So, pathos, sympathy, pity, curiosity. Yeah, okay, maybe. So there wasn't sufficient reason not to investigate the crime. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about there wasn't sufficient reason to capture the reader and make the reader interested in this dead person, this dead 15-year-old. That was the problem. And as soon as I realized that, I said, well, just unkill her. make her, as the Italians always use, ex. Mio ex marito. La mia ex casa. La mia ex macchina. La mia ex something. So I said, she's just going to be an ex-dead person. And the way to do that would be not to kill her. But then where does pity come from? And where does compassion come from? And where does sympathy come from? And where does curiosity come from? And where does interest come from? And why will the reader be seduced? Because if she's not killed, there's no reason to investigate her death, is there? So I said, okay, don't kill her, damage her. And then by doing that, but keeping the accident, because I had already written the description of the accident, and the grandmother's explanation of why the whole thing stank to her, why it didn't feel right to her, I realized that what I had to do was just use what I had written. She goes into the water, but she doesn't die. She goes into the water, and worse, much worse, she comes out damaged, but profoundly damaged, because while she was under the water for a couple of minutes, the oxygen was cut off to her brain. And so she was mentally damaged by the experience. So all of a sudden, instead of a person who died 15 years ago, 15 years before the events in the novel, for whom the reader would have sympathy only if the people in the book repeatedly gave them reason to be sympathetic about this dead person. Instead, she could be there. She could be in the book, beautiful, blonde, blue-eyed, very sympathetic, very kind, very affable, but very damaged. And so I didn't make her a 15-year-old. I made her a 7-year-old. And then all of a sudden, I've got what I want. A character in the book, a live character in the book, who, unless it is a rock who is reading the book, would elicit the sympathy of any reader. Because there's this constant contrast between her amiability and her ability. Between her appearance and her interior. And I think that this is what saved the book. Because had she not been a live character in the book, the book would have been very, very flat. Because she wouldn't have been there. And the reader, I think, would not have been seduced. As I think a reader would be in this one. Because she's sweet and she's damaged. And repeatedly, the reader is exposed to her. She becomes a very central character in the book. But always exposed in a way that would make the reader very, very sympathetic to her and to her plight. And make the reader much more interested in finding out whether she fell or whether she was pushed. Because if she's dead 15 years ago, okay, the question is there and it's a real question. Did she fall or was she pushed? But there's no compelling reason to want to care about it. And the reader in a novel has to care about somebody. No matter what you read, you have to care about somebody. And I can't remember which book it is of mine, and I shouldn't say this in public, but I will. There's one book where only a year after publication, I realized that's what was wrong with it. I really shouldn't say this, but it's the book about books. It's the book about books by its cover. That's what's wrong with that book. There's no one in the book who makes the reader care about them. The guy dies, yeah, okay. But that's what's wrong. So if any of you were left a little bit unpersuaded by that book or unmoved by that book, because I think the plot's okay, and the ending's very sneaky. But the characters in it, nobody, even the victim, doesn't elicit the sympathy, the aching sympathy that is elicited, I think, in this book. And I apologize if I've just destroyed your illusions about by its cover, but that, and it really didn't. It didn't come to me until well after the book was published. And I was talking about it with someone one day, and I said, yeah, that's what's wrong. And maybe I made up for it in this one, because I find Manuela a tremendous and achingly sympathetic character. Any questions about that? Or anything?
Thank you for sharing how you came to this plot. I have the advantage of not reading it yet.
Eek!
But you lost me a little bit, because I was wondering why someone would kill a 15-year-old, and now I'm wondering even more why someone would perhaps push a 7-year-old into the canal.
No, she was 15 when she went in the water.
Yeah.
But when she came out, she was only 7 years old mentally.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And I checked this with my friend Marco Lorenzini, who is my doctor friend. He's the chief surgeon at the Hospital of the Angels in Mestre. He is my medical consultant. Whenever I have a medical, I have two experts. I have a number of them, but the two who are most useful to me are Marco, Dottore, and a criminal lawyer in Verona, who answers my legal questions. But Marco assured me that this was possible. Marco was great on the book about the facelift, about face, because he's done hundreds of facelifts. And one day we went through the city years and years and years ago. And as we were walking along arm in arm, he'd say, "Look at the eyes. Look at the nose." And because he's been in the business for a long, long time and he's taught this, he could sometimes tell me who had done the job. Not because he knew the patient, but because he could tell from the work who produces that particular kind of configuration on the face. Sorry, someone had another question. Yes.
One of the things I enjoy about your books...
Pay attention to whatever she has to say.
...is the contrasting families, the aristocratic in-laws and the family of our hero. And I was just wondering if you base them on people in Venice with whom you had contact and socialized with, particularly the aristocratic family. They're so inaccessible, whereas the other family is so warm and opening.
Well, inaccessible, I don't know whether that's the word I'd use. I know a lot of aristocrats in Venice because I was introduced into that circle by a friend of mine who was not an aristocrat, but who travels with them. I've met lots of them in the last 10 years or so, and I find them very much like other people. They just happen to... Let me give you an example. They have been Venetian since... Their great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Doge in 1327. And many of the Venetians can say that, that they had a Doge in the family history, and that they are directly descended from that person. But once I asked a friend of mine who runs a restaurant how long his family had been in Venice, if his family was originally Venetian, he said yes. And I said, "How long has your family been in Venice?" And he said, "Oh, since about the 12th century." So regular people as well go back 1,000 years. They can trace their families back maybe 600-700 years. The people who are not nobles, who were not doges, who didn't keep genealogy books, they can do it more easily. But there's verbal testimony in the families of lots of other Venetians, because they've always been there, just that they don't have titles. I find them quite pleasant people. One of the things about them is that they are gloriously polite. Because I'm sure it was beaten into them by nannies when they were young. But they are exquisitely polite. I've never known anyone to say or do anything out of place, and I like that. It makes civil interaction or social interaction at a certain level of superficiality. It makes it very, very pleasant when you deal with polite people. When you know that no one's going to be embarrassing or make a fool of him or herself. I quite like them. I don't see them as my friends, but I like them. I like them and respect them. Yes. And nobody in the books is anybody. There are no characters. No, there's only one character who is a real person. There's only one character in the book who is a real person, other than Signorina Elettra. She's based on a friend. In one of the early books, there is a scene in which a woman makes her coffee in the morning. She's drinking her coffee, and she looks out the window, looks down into the canal, and she sees a body, and she says, "Oh, Dio," and she drops her coffee cup. And her name is given as Bianca Pianato. Bianca Pianato is the mother of my best friend in Venice. Biba and I have been... Biba's the one who wrote the cookbook. Biba and I have been best friends for 50 years, almost 50 years. And Biba's husband, Franco, has been one of my best friends for 48 years, because I met him 2 years after Biba did. Bianca, and the book, I think, is dedicated to Biba and Bianca. When the book was published in English, I took it to Bianca's house because I was invited there for dinner, and I said, Biba, this is, of course, all in Italian, Biba, I have something to read to Bianca. And Bianca looked at me and said, ah, and I said, no, I want to read you something from the new book. I said, Bianca, I'll read it, I'll translate it into English, okay? So she was cooking dinner, and I said, and on the morning, open, and Bianca Pianaro, and Bianca, who was at the sink, went, so me, it's me. I said, see, Bianca, see. And she, occasionally, years pass, and every once in a while I can see that Bianca's getting a little nervous. She needs a fix, so I'll bring the book and read her the passage again. She's just so thrilled to be in the book, which she'll never read, of course. But sorry, someone had a question.
I'd like to continue on your theme of the name, because I wanted to ask you how you chose the name of Brunetti. It rolls so nicely off the tongue. I delight in, when I discuss your books, of just saying Commissario Brunetti. It's... And how did it come to you immediately, or did you discard other things?
I was in the cemetery for some reason, and I saw Famiglia Brunetti. There was an enormous I found it since then. There's an enormous tomb in the wall, and it says Famiglia Brunetti, where all of the members of the Brunetti family, because it's not a Venetian name, it's a name from the north, from Friuli, and I thought, yeah, that's a good name. But then, that was much before I thought about writing the books. And when he stepped out of the boat, and I don't particularly like the name Guido, but it seemed, Guido Brunetti seemed to sing, so I chose that name. But very often for the names, I look at doorbells. Or I look in the phone book. Because there have been so many people in these books. Who knew that this would go on and on? Yes? Oh, sorry.
25 books that Guido Brunetti is not more
cynical. Oh, he is.
A lot of Italians, they seem much more cynical.
Oh, they are. Yeah, he's pretty cynical. But he has the comfort of a loving family, so that sort of tempers a bit. Sorry, there's a. Joyce DiDonato, for those of you, those three people in this room who don't know who she is an American mezzo-soprano who has had a tremendous success in Europe and in America. She sings at the Met all the time. Joyce is maybe the best singer I've ever heard. Maybe. Because I've heard lots of very good singers. She's also a very, very old friend. I've known Joyce for 15 years. We've been friends for most of that time. And one of the books is dedicated to her. So I'm not an objective judge of Joyce's personality or talent, although I think her talent is daunting. In the conversation, we talked a lot about singing, why she sings, how she trains, how she practices, what she wants to do with her talent. But I would rather talk about something that Joyce told me when I was in Barcelona to see my Spanish publisher, but I stayed a day extra, and I went to see Joyce because she's now living at least part-time in Barcelona. And we had dinner at her place in Barcelona. And she told me about a project. Ah, yeah. Those of you who look at YouTube, take a look at a YouTube thing that's called Carnegie Hall and then Sing Sing. And it's not a verb. It's not a double verb. Carnegie Hall, Sing Sing. Carnegie Hall, for the last I don't know how many years, has had a program teaching music, but teaching music composition to convicted felons in Sing Sing. Joyce is now involved in this project. And she told me about going to Sing Sing, which she did last year, to teach singing and to give a concert. And I sat like the Pasha with Scheherazade telling the story, just stunned by what she recounted. She had a student who was in, who had been there, I think, for 18 years. And she taught, he showed her the music of the song he had written, and he sang it. He asked her to sing it. She sang it. And she suggested a change in the lyrics, which he made. And the guy said something to the effect of, well, when I was a stupid kid, and when I was young, I didn't know anything. I really didn't know anything. All I knew was that if somebody did something bad to you, you did something bad to them. And if someone did something worse to you, you did something worse to them. And then he said, and then I took away a man's future, which is as delicate a euphemism as I could come up with. So she said that at the concert that was given sometime later, she agreed to sing two arias. And this guy sang one of his songs. And when he got up, he stood in front of the microphone and he said, I'd like to dedicate this song to the memory of my victim. So there's hope, boys and girls. No, I always kid Joyce about her desire to make the world a better place, because she really has it. But I was moved to goosebumps by her telling this. Then she told about herself singing two arias in the theater, because they have a theater at Sing Sing.
Oh, why do you let these people have music? You should be punished for what they did. Can't give them any money for them. Keep them in jail for 100 years.
At any rate, they came to the concert, and they were separated, the one gang over here and one gang over there. Otherwise, there would have been trouble, the 320 people. So Joyce started with one of the Handel ones. I don't remember which it was. One of the arias from Giulio Cesare, in which a person, a mezzo-soprano, sings about wanting vengeance and then not wanting vengeance and accepting what had happened. She sang that. But before that, she explained what the song was about, because she was going to sing it in Italian. So she sang it in Italian. They listened. And then she sang for her second one, Tanti Palpiti, from the end, from Cenerentola, where she just goes, it's just a skyrocket aria. So she told them that at the end of it, this girl has forgiven everybody. It's Cinderella. And she forgives her stupid father and her wicked stepsisters. And she sings about the tanti palpiti that are beating at her heart. And there's tanti palpiti in the music. So she started, and she said, I didn't know what I should do. I didn't know how I should sing it to them. And then she said, why don't I just sing it like I'm in the Met? So she started singing, and she said, after the first, towards the end of the A section, she started hearing, yay, Joyce! Yay! Go, girl, go, go, go! Way to go, Joyce! And then she sang the quieter part, and then she sang the absolutely pyrotechnic ending of the aria, and they went berserk. I think we can safely assume that these guys had never heard opera arias. And certainly not in a small theater, and certainly not by someone of her ability. Then there was a moment of absolute panic among the police staff, because all of these guys jumped out of their seats, and they wanted Joyce's autograph. So they had to get them on lines, and it took an hour to get them out of it. So I think that's a much better story than the talk that she gave in Zurich. And she's going back in October to teach again. And Joyce is... I work with an orchestra, with an opera orchestra, Il Pomodoro, who will be in New York on December 15th with Joyce. Joyce is giving a concert, I think at Carnegie Hall, on December 15th of this year, of her new disc, which she recorded 2 weeks ago in Dobbiaco in Italy, which is... I was there for most of the recording, and it is just breathtakingly wonderful. when the sound technician puts it together, it will be glorious, December 15th. And she's, the next project we have with Joyce, I think, can't be until the end of 2017. She's that booked. And she likes us, but she's just booked solid until, I guess, 2:20. I'm sure she's booking for 2:20. But she's taking time out of a schedule this busy to go back to Sing Sing and teach again. And so I find her, she's one of the few people I've known in my life for whom I have absolute respect, both professionally for what she does, but personally, because she is, Joyce is really neat. And great singer. If you want to hear her, get the what's it called? The one with the Vivian Westwood dress. She wears a red Vivian dress. I should know. It'll come to me. Drama Queens, yeah. She sings all of the arias of the great big Drama Queens. You've heard it, the person who shouted out the Drama Queens. It's very, very good. Joyce is very good. Another question? Yep.
All right. Okay.
Feel free
Your
to
count
emulate.
Is Falliere.
Yeah.
And that's a famous name in the history of Venice, uh-huh. And I wondered why you chose it. And when we were in Venice, we went to try to find Palazzo Falliere.
And it's not where it is in the book, is it? No.
Well, what it is now, Palazzo Falliere, is some kind of commercial building, as if not only did the family fall, but their home fell into a commercial building. Yeah. So why did you pick, rather than making up some count with a name that you picked out of a hat? Why that one?
I wanted it to be a name, an aristocratic name, that is recognizably Venetian. And certainly Falliere is that. There's a Falliere Palazzo in Canareggio, right off the Grand Canal, on the way back to the Misericordia. I think that's the only one that still bears the name Falliere. But it's not commercial, so there must be another one. Most of the names of the people who are in the books have authentic Venetian names, and I think. I don't know any Falliers, and I didn't know anyone who knew anyone, so I don't know whether the line continues. I should have looked in the phone book, but I didn't. But it's a convincing name for a person in this book of wealth and influence, as are many of them still, the Foscari, a lot of them. The Loredan.
I've loved all of the books for different reasons, but I'm wondering if your writing style has changed at all with these last few books, because there have been two books, more current books, that have really upset me.
Good.
And I've never gotten upset earlier.
How kind of you to say.
One of them was the little boy that whose mother never spoke to him.
Yeah, that's nice, huh?
That really got me. And the other one was the snuff film.
Oh, no, the snuff film is terrible. The snuff film is just horrible.
And I just wondered if your writings had deepened or the world is more upsetting than it used to be or what.
Well, I think that the books are becoming more cynical. The books are becoming bleaker and blacker. But that, I think, is the result of the fact that I am, that my vision of the world becomes bleaker and blacker as time passes. However, because I have the very good fortune to have been born of happy people, I am, fallback or whatever it is? Default, thank you, is that I'm a happy person. I've always been a happy person. But that's a kind of heart thing. And disposition thing. But intellectually, I just couldn't be more cynical. And that comes into the books. And anyone who lives in Italy for any amount of time... No, really. So I think sees the difficulties of the state and the corruption of the state are more evident in Italy. I don't think they're particularly greater in Italy, but they are more evident because the newspapers are filled with them every day. And most people have been, most Italians, I believe, have been battered down by the bleakness of the behavior of their politicians until they're just sort of numb. Yeah, that's a good word. Thank you. They're numb. My friends are they don't even talk about it anymore. They just, because what can they say? And one thing I must confess is true, is that much of what I know I don't put in the books, because one rule I have to obey is that I can never leave footprints back to my source. I can never make it evident where I got a particular idea or I got a particular piece of information. And so things, the sex of people change, is changed, so men become women and women become men, so that it becomes less easy to identify where I might have learned something. Because I hear things all the time that I cannot put in books, because there's no absolute certainty that the story that I was told is in fact true. And so I don't want to risk putting something like that in the book. But what is true is you've all heard about the Mose project, the dams that are gonna stop the waters of the Adriatic from flooding the city. Last year, all 14 members of the board of the company in charge of Mose were arrested. And the mayor, Orsoni, the mayor of Venice, was forced to resign because he finally, after some weeks of not remembering and denying, remembered that he had in fact taken 350,000 euros from Consorzio, what is it, Consorzio Veneto? Consorzio, I don't remember. The master company that is running the Mose project. And the man in charge, the engineer in charge of the whole project, is now living in Mexico and too old to be arrested. The project, yeah, doesn't it sound familiar? The project has cost somewhere between 7 and 30 billion, no one's quite sure, euros. And no one is quite sure, no one's sure of anything. Because one of the things that was built into the original contract was that when they put something up for bid to build this part, to do this dredging, to do this cleaning, to make this, to go there, to do that, there didn't have to be any bidding. The consortio could just accept any contract it wanted. Nice, huh? Nice. But the mayor is in truth a just man of great conscience, and we know that because he used to be the lawyer of the church in Venice. Said in his own defense, one must believe him. He said that he was not guilty of corruption, because when he accepted the 350,000 euros, it was during his election campaign, and he did not keep the money. He gave it to his election campaign to spend on his campaign. I'm not making this up. I read it in Il Gazzettino, which delights me every day of my life. And a Venetian friend of mine used to say, for those of you who understand Italian, per diventar cretin, to become a cretin, leggi il Gazzettino. Read the Gazzettino.
I've seen the German TV series.
That's more than I can say. Yes?
He was not my Brunetti.
It was not my they are not my books, so it wouldn't be then. It wouldn't be Brunetti, would it?
Okay.
No, I think I saw two of them, and at one point, I said, "What the hell's going on here? I didn't write that." So I thought it would be better not to look at any more. But I'm at the moment dealing with the BBC. I have to go to London next month to talk to the BBC.
Do you have a visual in your head of your characters? Do you when you're writing or when you're thinking about it, do you see Brunetti? Do
No.
you see his wife?
No, I have no idea what they look like. I will see. I know very little. I know that Brunetti is tall, tallish, and robusto, and his wife is blonde and has a big nose. But other than that, I don't know anything because I don't visualize them when I write about them. So whoever acts the part of Brunetti, that's fine with me, because the other thing that the BBC can't understand is I've never owned a television in my life. So, yay! And even better, I don't have a telefonino. Huh? It's nice. But because I don't have a television, when the people from the BBC, and I almost never go to the movies, so when they try to wham me by telling me the actors that they're thinking of hiring, I just say, "Oh, really? Okay." And when they ask me if I have any suggestions for who should play Brunetti, I invariably say to them, "Marcello Mastroianni." So negotiations are going to be very interesting with the BBC. Oh well, never mind.
So in your books, you often refer to Brunetti speaking to other Venetians with a Venetian dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a few people who are studying Italian, but no one has actually heard the Venetian dialect. Can you give us an example of, like, classic Italian versus the Venetian dialect?
Yeah, Venetian dialect sort of forgets about L. So figlia becomes fia. Figlio, fio. Frateo. Che bello! Che bello! Che bello! They just don't like to say L, and they shorten things. So dietro becomes drio, and they use one thing that is not Veneziano, but is very Venetian, is to put the L, the la, before a woman's name, so that if you have a friend and you're referring to your friend Giulia, and you're saying that Giulia will come. In Venice, all people say, "Ah, sì, ho visto la Giulia." I saw the Giulia. "Ho visto la Bianca, ho visto la Biba, ho visto la..." Only for women. And only, I'm told it's done in Venice, it's done in Milano as well, but I don't know. But it is definitely done in Venice. It's one of the peculiarities of Veneziano. Italians tell me that it's very, very difficult to understand, but I don't know that because it's what I hear all the time. I don't speak it, and I don't try to speak it because I think that would be hideously pretentious. My Italian is okay, but I understand Veneziano, but to speak it, you really have to be born into the language, and I think there'd be a certain measure of arrogance in trying to imitate it, or they would take it as a mockery. It's lovely. I always feel very, very relaxed when I hear it again.
In this book, I want to thank you for, I think, the incredible courage. You talked about the compassion that you didn't kill her and brought her back. And as a reader, not only did I feel the compassion for the girl, but for her mother, and you didn't make her mother sappy having a child with such an extraordinary disability. You made it real, and that was extraordinary. Just, it's an extraordinary gift, and I'm
that's very nice to hear.
Grateful.
Willing suspension of disbelief. You can go back to Coleridge.
It's beautifully done.
Thanks. He says that for a work of, he's talking about poetry, what is it, Biografia Letteraria, he says that in poetry, the reader must engage in the willing suspension of disbelief. You have to, and when you read fiction, it's true. You can't fight it. You can't say, oh, no, that did not matter. It has to be real so that the reader thinks that this passel of lies, which is what poetry and novels are, is true. Otherwise, they're not going to like it. I used the word seduce earlier, and I think that that is part of the job of a writer, to seduce the reader into believing that what he or she is reading is real, and then they will respond to it. Otherwise, they won't. They can't if it's fake, if it's patently fake. Either they're just reading for the storyline. But I believe that, and I often reflect upon that, the willing suspension of disbelief. Because if you don't do it in a novel, it's, or in a poem, it's, then your work is just a waste of time. But thank you very much. I'm glad. Yeah, she's a nice character, the mother. And she's not particularly nice. Yes. But why do people always have to be nice? Nice is such a worthless quality. No. I mean that sincerely. Nice is very pleasant. But it's meaningless. Being nice or saying nice things, it doesn't mean anything. Because nothing changes if you're nice or if you say nice things. It's only what you do that counts. And sometimes saying things is doing when you console people. But all this politeness stuff and all this an example of what I mean is this nonsense with the verb to share things. God, I hate it. I have something I want to share with you. Do you mean you want to tell me something? Because if you wanted to share, give me half of your sandwich. But why not just say, I have something I want to tell you? I think it's a kind of, it's an attempt to make what you say sound more serious, more real, more sincere. I have something I want to share with you. No, tell me. I'm sorry, it's a word that just pushes.
I think your greatest seduction in all of the books, and I've read them all, is the seduction that you achieve with Venice itself.
Yeah, because so many people dislike it and think it's a dump.
You know, I read Traveling in the Footsteps of Brunetti, mm-hmm. as well as all of them. And the last time I went back to Venice, I went back wanting to go where Brunetti had been. Yeah. And I found myself reading, after the first three or four books, I read every book with a map in front of me.
Good.
And I think you really do have the greatest seduction in your descriptions of Venice, and they're always there, and they're always precise, and they're always wonderful.
And they're always short. Yeah. They're always short. I don't like food porn, and I don't like travel porn.
I always read two books at once, one of fact and one of fiction. I was reading a book called Lingo about the languages of Europe at the same time I was reading your present book. And there's a chapter on the fact that Italian has more unpleasant diminutives about women than any other language. And I always see in your books a little bit of anger about how women are treated in Italy. I don't know if it's any worse than the United States, but there's certainly, since a lot of your strong characters are women, yet all these men are very dismissive of them. Is that something that I'm just seeing, or is it really there?
No, I think it's true. I think if you live enough time in the world, well, not that you have the option of living anywhere else, men have a kind of casually dismissive attitude towards women, which women have learned to put up with over the years, and it's the old normal, and I think that to point it out is not look at Parliament in Italy, look at Parliament here, you really don't see a lot of red dresses in either of the halls. Women are represented very, very badly in business, in academia, and in certainly in politics. But this is not peculiar to Italy. I think it is peculiar to the world. But I'm glad you noticed it. Because it's, yeah, why not just... And I like to think that that what the books do is say, take a look at that. Take a look at that. What do you think about that? You like that? Rather than... Because that's the kiss of death for a book. To preach, to tell the reader what the reader has to think about a particular ethical or social issue. Also, I would like you to bear in mind that a lot of the ideas which seem to be expressed by Brunetti are not necessarily my ideas. That a lot of the ideas that are expressed in the books are not mine. And a lot of my ideas are not expressed in the books. But that's not my business. I'm not a preacher. So it really doesn't matter what I think about anything. As long as I can say to a willing reader, take a look at this. What do you think about this? You think this is good stuff that this happens? I left Zurich, whenever I left Zurich, Friday, with one chapter to write in the next book. I have 31 chapters, 410 pages of manuscript written of the next book, which is called Earthly Remains, with a double meaning. And I don't know, and I swear on my mother's head, I'm a terrible liar, but if I swear on my mother's head, I will not lie, I do not know how the book is going to end. So I'm taking some time off to think about it. I just don't know. Oh, one thing. The next book is, everybody calls it the bee book, because the book is about bees. I have spent the last 6 months of my life reading about bees. And they are as close to the divine as I have ever experienced in my life. The beehive is perfection. And I'll stop there.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.